I'm Abigail Galvan. Welcome to EWTN Pro-Life Weekly.
What I think is needed is targeted segment-based messaging and the research to support how to optimize messaging to the different audiences that we're trying to convince of the position that we have in the pro-life movement.
Voters in several states set to cast ballots for or against life. Analysis on the messaging that is influencing the American vote.
When it comes to these buffer zones, you have one person praying silently in her head, and now she can be arrested in the UK. So it's completely draconian.
Pro-life activists arrested under buffer zone laws in the UK, some even for silent prayer.
We wrote this book in a simple question and answer format so that people, if they had a specific question, they can look it up easily, and it's in easy language, and hopefully we lay out the church's teaching.
Making your last wishes known to loved ones before your time comes. A new book explains how to adhere to church teaching in end-of-life decisions.
The fundamental freedom of Americans to make decisions about their own bodies and not have their government tell them what to do.
Will abortion swing the first post-Roe presidential election? Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris is betting on it, as she has based much of her campaign on the issue. Harris confirmed to NBC News' Hallie Jackson that she would oppose religious exemptions in abortion laws. In the meantime, former President Trump has left his once strong pro-life stance in favor of looking more moderate on life issues. We are days away from the 2024 presidential election, and the race is neck and neck. While the presidential candidates embark on last-minute campaign tours in hopes of influencing Americans to vote for them, voters in 10 states across the country will also be asked to vote for or against life. Take a look. Several states already have extremely liberal laws where abortion is legal in all 9 months of pregnancy, like Maryland and Colorado. Yet they are seeking to enshrine abortion in their state's constitution. In New York, it is legal until 24 weeks, but there are exceptions, including the mental health of a mother, which would allow abortion up to the moment of birth.
We have concerns that that could lead to courts basically interpreting the rights of minors to be, you know, on equal footing with adults, thereby stripping away parents' rights.
New York goes a step further in its Prop 1 ballot, known as the Equal Rights Amendment, to include gender identity protections, which can override parental consent for children seeking life-altering gender reassignment. Two very pro-life states will unfortunately have abortion ballot measures. Missouri, where abortion is illegal with limited exceptions, could see it expand to allow abortion until viability. South Dakota, where babies are protected during all 9 months of pregnancy, has an initiative to constitutionalize abortion and prevent the state from regulating it in the first trimester, but allow for some regulations in the second trimester. Florida, where a 6-week abortion limit just took effect in May of this year, could be obliterated with Amendment 4, which would expand abortion until viability or beyond if a woman gets approval from a health care provider.
It would wipe out all the pro-life laws in Florida, very likely. It would eliminate the parental involvement law. There's a very good chance it would require taxpayer funding of abortion through Florida's Medicaid program. And it would also essentially legalize abortion throughout all 9 months of pregnancy.
Parental consent for minors seeking an abortion could also be removed. In Florida, the measure needs 60% of voters to approve it in order for it to pass. Montana voters will decide on keeping the current viability abortion law, which is around 24 weeks. And two competing abortion measures will be on the ballot in Nebraska. One measure, Initiative 434, would keep the current 12-week limit for exceptions for rape, incest, and life of the mother. Initiative 439 would enshrine abortion up until viability, about 24 weeks.
It's very clear, Catholics in Nebraska should be voting against Initiative 439. It is an unsafe, unregulated, un-Nebraskan abortion proposal.
Catholic leaders are asking voters to choose the lesser of two evils there. the two swing states with abortion measures, Nevada and Arizona. Arizona allows abortion up until the 15th week of pregnancy, when some doctors say the baby is capable of feeling pain. Voters there could extend the window of abortion up until viability. In Nevada, voters will decide on whether or not to enshrine the current abortion law of 24 weeks into the state constitution. Exceptions for the physical or mental health of the mother has the Nevada right to life concerned.
In our law, viability is defined as 6 months, 24 weeks. That's going to go away, and it will be replaced with a viability standard that's left up to the abortionist. Health is a big... It's a big loophole. Health is considered emotional health, financial health. It can be any number of things, any kinds of transitory conditions that could be just today I'm not feeling good and I don't feel like I can do this.
Nevada has two election cycles, so the measure needs to pass this year and then again in 2026. So we won't have results for another 2 years. Hans Platte, president of Enea Research, has over 25 years of experience providing professional market research to industry-leading companies. He's also worked with major pro-life organizations like Students for Life. He joins us now to provide insight on what could be hurting the pro-life messaging. Hans, thank you so much for joining us today. So, state abortion ballot initiatives have not lost once in the wake of the overturning of Roe. How much of this would you attribute to the pro-abortion side's messaging?
A good amount. I really think there are two things that are going on. While overturning of Roe was obviously a very good thing, I think it happened without having sufficiently changed the hearts and minds of people on abortion, which is why we're seeing what we're seeing at the state level. And so more work needs to be done there, specifically, as you say, on messaging and the delivery of that message. Unfortunately, the other side has come to own compassion. But really, we are the ones that should own compassion. We have the truly compassionate position. But the other side has cornered us with good narratives, right? We force women to carry the child, according to them, right? We force women and babies into poverty. And so we need to work stronger around coming up with better messaging to overcome that.
You're exactly right. So I know you've mentioned that research plays a large role in developing winning language. If I may say, what research opportunities do you see that could help the pro-life movement have more wins at the state level?
Yeah, so I don't know exactly what is happening in the pro-life movement for all of the different messages and the strategies or research and strategy that they do. But I would think of research as something that isn't a particular study, but it's a program, right? You need to do research to understand who are we trying to convince, what are their current beliefs. Then you use that to develop a variety of different messaging options that you then test in research, refine through research, and then you measure the impact of change. And I don't know that all of that has been done. I think the second thing around this is that we have to recognize that we're really not targeting a certain population or a single population, but rather a variety of different demographics or different segments, as we call them, right? So you've got women, you've got men, you've got different age groups, religious beliefs, et cetera. And so what I think is needed is targeted segment-based messaging and the research to support how to optimize messaging to the different audiences that we're trying to convince of the position that we have in the pro-life movement.
That makes sense. Pro-abortionists using the viability language seems to be helping them get these amendments on the ballot. How do we combat their narrative?
Well, so we have to start now, right? And so I've gotten a couple of requests for different messaging studies within a year of when an initiative was going to come to light. And really, it needs to start, like I said, now for Nevada and maybe even for Florida. So right now, things look positive for Florida only because they have that 60% threshold limit. But I think if we win, we'll barely win. And I think it will embolden the other side to try again, either in 26 or 28. And this is a program that needs to start, you know, pretty soon, because you need to identify the optimal message to the audience, and they need to hear it repeatedly before they will actually adopt it and have it change their hearts and minds, which is obviously what we're trying to do here.
Yeah. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I think I think I would say, you know, hope is something that I've always felt is needed in this area, mm-hmm. and really just to think about how best to use research to help along the way. I think it's utilized, but probably being underutilized.
Thank you so much, Hans. Don't forget to check out the Catholic News Agency's interactive map on state abortion ballots. Head over to CatholicNewsAgency.com and scroll to the bottom. Another life-based amendment to keep an eye on is in West Virginia. Voters will decide on amending the state constitution to prohibit participation in or the practice of medically assisted suicide or similar actions like euthanasia or mercy killing. In the state of Ohio, a judge struck down the state's heartbeat law late last week. The law protected life after cardiac activity is detected as early as 6 weeks into pregnancy. The judge said that last year's voter-approved amendment enshrining abortion as a right into the state constitution renders the pro-life law as unconstitutional. National buffer zone laws preventing pro-life activists from gathering near abortion facilities take effect across England and Wales starting October 31st. Multiple towns throughout the United Kingdom already have laws prohibiting pro-life activists from gathering near an abortion facility. Some even criminalize silent prayer. It's resulted in multiple arrests, including Isabel Von Spruce, co-director for the March for Life UK, who was arrested twice in Birmingham, England, for praying silently in her head outside an abortion facility in 2022. Now, a pro-life woman living in Edinburgh, Scotland, where a similar buffer zone law took effect in September, fears she'll be arrested simply because she lives inside the buffer zone. She received a letter from the government noting that it is a criminal offense to influence someone within 656 feet of an abortion facility to not seek or perform an abortion. It also states that activities in a private place, such as a house, within the zone could be an offense. The law carries a fine of more than $13,000. As we told you several weeks ago, Adam Smith Connor was arrested in 2022 for silently praying outside an abortion clinic. A court convicted him earlier this month and fined him nearly $11,000. Pro-life advocate Dr. Colin Miller has been on the forefront speaking for the unborn at rallies, marches, online, and more. I had the opportunity to speak with him here in our studio when he was visiting the U.S. a few weeks ago. He talked about his concern for these buffer zone laws and shared what the pro-life community there is doing to protect life. Thank you so much for being with us today, Colm. Before we talk to you about the buffer zone laws, can you tell us what kind of a community of pro-lifers exists in England, Scotland, and Wales?
Yeah, so we're very small. So we're about 5% of the population. So it's, you know, we're a very small minority. We're not very popular, sadly. But we have a lot of wonderful leaders, very dedicated people. And despite that small number, we're actually able to get quite a lot done, both in politics and in the culture and otherwise. So we have some wonderful committed people, some great organizations. We don't just have one. We have, a number of pro-life groups. And so Scotland, England, and Wales, for the pro-life movement, function kind of as one. It's kind of a British pro-life movement, yeah. But there are a few differences. So Scotland is a bit more pro-abortion, mm-hmm. and, they have a bit of a tougher time.
Okay.
England is a bit more conservative, not massively, but a little bit mm-hmm. more. So, yeah, it's different political dynamics, different political parties in power in the country, so that affects things. So things happen at different times in the countries, but generally we're kind of all together. We're not super popular, but we have some wonderful leaders and fighting the good fight, willing to get arrested even for it.
That's incredible. To inspire us. Okay, so practically speaking, what effect does the buffer zone laws have on pro-life advocates?
So this doesn't just affect pro-life advocates. It affects the women, of course, themselves, because they get deprived of the opportunity to get support. You know, we know women who have gone on record, spoken in the parliament and everything, talking about how they went to get an abortion. And because there was someone outside, they realized that they didn't really want an abortion and that they wanted the child, but they had no support for that. So so the censorship zones, as we call them, have a huge impact in terms of, you know, giving women support and saving babies' lives. But in terms of the pro-life advocates as well, it is a basic deprivation of their freedoms, whether free speech, free assembly, freedom of religion, freedom of conscience, freedom of protest. Whereas when it comes to these buffer zones, you have one person praying silently in her head, and now she can be arrested in the UK. So it's completely draconian. One of my good friends has been arrested 3 times for praying silently in her head.
Wow.
So the police even went to her and they asked her, what are you praying about? And it was because she was praying about abortion that she was arrested. If she was praying about anything else, it would have been fine.
Okay.
So people said, you know, she was breaking the law because she was in the zone, but that's not the case. The reason she was breaking the law is because of the content of her thoughts and prayers. So it's literally thought crime in the 1984 sense. And so these are now across the country, and we're yet to see what exactly will be allowed, what won't be allowed, but I suspect we'll see more of the same, that people will be arrested just for praying silently in their heads.
So how are pro-life communities pivoting to deal with this?
So I think at the moment we're still trying to figure out where, how far exactly does the law extend. So the law, you know, claims to prevent protest, intimidation, harassment, and this is basically made up, you know, that harassment is already illegal, intimidation and abuse is already illegal, and as far as I know, there have never been any convictions for actual harassment or anything like that outside of a clinic.
Okay.
It's a non-problem. So they claim to be preventing this, but in fact, they prevent, you know, even thought crime and things like that, or offering help. So I think what pro-lifers want to say is, we want to be able to pray silently in our heads, at least. And we want to be able to have consensual conversations, because that is a woman's choice. It's a woman's right to have a conversation about abortion within the zone if she wants, and the right to access support and help if she wants. And so we're trying to push for that and trying to sort of establish a compromise where we say harassment is wrong. All of us are against that. Of course, you know, we'll need to move online anyway, because many abortions are done now, not by going to a clinic, but by just ordering the pills online or on the phone and having the pills at home and doing these do-it-yourself abortions, which are very dangerous, caused a lot of complications already. But that's the situation we're kind of in. And I think in that sense, we needed to do stuff online anyway to actually reach women more and more. And so in that sense, I think it's sort of pushing us in a direction that we already needed to go. So it's maybe not as bad as it might have been 10 years ago, where most women visited the clinic. But of course, it's still a huge, huge problem.
Callum, thank you so much for being here with us today. We so appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
If you would like to learn more about Callum Miller's pro-life work in the UK, you can head to his website, columnsblog.com, C-A-L-U-M-S-blog.com, or follow him on social media at Dr. Callum Miller on X. Coming up next on EWTN Pro-Life Weekly, a new book walks Catholics through end-of-life decisions that align with church teaching. We speak with the author. Stay with us. We'll be right back. October 31st marks All Hallows' Eve, the eve of All Saints' Day, secularly known as Halloween. All Saints' Day is followed by All Souls' Day, when we pray for the souls of our departed loved ones. In many Latin American cultures, particularly in Mexico, these feasts are celebrated as the Day of the Dead. Traditions include placing photos and artifacts of loved ones on home altars as a way to honor and remember them. You can find these altars in churches across the U.S. and in Latin America, so parishioners can pray for their lost friends and family members. Nearing the end of life can mean, in some cases, making a major ethical decision. Quality of life, pain, the use of life-prolonging technology, and withdrawing treatment are just some of the issues that a patient and their loved ones can face. A recently released book called Now and at the Hour of Our Death, Making Moral Decisions at the End of Life, helps Catholics who want to align their decisions with church teaching. The co-author Nicholas T. Nicas spoke with Montse Alvarado about the importance of learning to navigate through end-of-life care situations.
What prompted you to co-author this new book?
Well, this book is the product of many talks on end-of-life decision-making in parishes over the last 10, 15, 20 years. And it's the questions we received at the end of those presentations. And what we realized is, yeah, there are maybe a small percentage of people who consider themselves Catholic and just say, no one is going to tell me what to do at the end of life. But for most people in the parishes, they really wanted to do the right thing. They just were never taught, and they had lots of questions. And so we wrote this book to be a resource for the average Catholic about how to prepare before the crisis hits on end-of-life decision-making. Look, if someone dies in a car accident, that's a horrible, terrible shock. But there's really no decision-making except funeral and taking care of someone's estate. But if someone gets an illness or someone gets a chronic situation where it's the long goodbye, as people say, then you have lots of questions because of our modern technology. And technology is a two-edged sword. On the one hand, it keeps us alive. On the other hand, it could do things that 200 years ago, there wouldn't be a question. And so people are confused because, A, they haven't been taught. And then, B, medical terminology is not familiar to most people. And three, end-of-life decisions require the virtue of prudence, knowing the right thing to do at the right time. And that's not an easy virtue. I've lived a long life, and I do not claim to have really mastered the virtue of prudence. So because of all these reasons, we wrote this book in a simple question and answer format so that people, if they had a specific question, you know, what does the church teach about hydration and nutrition, food and water? Mm-hmm. The church teach about any of these? We can, they can look it up easily, and it's in easy language, and hopefully we lay out the church's teaching.
Right. Well, that's a great resource and one that I think has a great methodology behind it because it's a Q&A. It's easy to go to. What would you say, then, of all of the questions that you answer and also the questions that you received throughout these speaking engagements is the biggest issue or the biggest question that Catholics and their families face at the end of life?
Well, the biggest overall issue, of course, is when to accept medical intervention and when to say it's not morally required and you can either refuse it or you can remove it. Now, the church teaches that the principle is easy to state, it's hard to apply. The principle is everybody has a moral duty to use ordinary or proportionate care, but you don't have a duty to use extraordinary, or disproportionate care. Now, simply saying that doesn't tell you anything. I say that to people, and I say, okay, thanks for coming, and then I'm going to leave. No one really has an understanding of that. So the difficult question is, so what everyone wants in our technological age is an algorithm. You know, if you always put these three facts in, crank it three times, here's the answer. And that's not how this works. This is why, again, the reason we wrote this book also was to say, look, you can't think clearly once a crisis hits. Once your loved one is in distress, it's very hard to think rationally. So prepare beforehand. And this book hopefully sets that out. But that's the biggest issue. And then the church also says that this disproportionate or ordinary care, trying to figure all this out, depends on the, quote, concrete circumstances, end quote, of a person's condition. So if I had 50 people in a room,
all 50 people are going to die differently, different right. diseases, different circumstances, who has more money. You know, if you're Jeff Bezos and you have to pay $1 million a day for a medical intervention, it's not a big deal. But 99.99% of the people, they're simply not going to be able to afford it. So there's no one clear, easy answer. We're not, the church isn't relativistic. The church's principles are clear and timeless. But it's the application that's difficult.
Right, it is. It's a huge challenge. Do you think, and in the questions that you've received, that doctors pressure patients and their families to make immoral decisions or decisions that the Catholic Church would consider questionable? And how can Catholics be prepared for that besides being well-informed themselves?
You know, I don't want to paint broadly, you know, all doctors do this.
Of course not, right.
Just like, you know, as a lawyer, you know, all lawyers are this or all lawyers are that. There are doctors who understand the right principles, and there are doctors who don't. The one thing is you can't assume that the medical profession, like the legal profession, is always going to have your best interest spiritually at heart. So one of the things we recommend in the book, not as a legal issue, legal issues, we say, go to your licensed and competent attorney and have them draft whatever you need. But from a moral position, we say, appoint someone who is well-formed in the faith to be your durable healthcare power of attorney in case you're incapacitated. And then they can advocate for you. But they can only advocate for you if they understand the church's teaching, which is another reason we wrote this book, so that people could say, once a crisis hits, or if you're incapacitated, you're in a coma, whatever, then someone who knows the church's teaching can say yes here, but no here for these moral reasons.
Now, you are a lawyer. You've mentioned that, and I promise I won't make any lawyer jokes. But the reality is that this has become a legal issue that's being legislated around the country and around the world, at the country level and at the state level. Does your book say anything about the growing trends on euthanasia, or does it play into this arena of specialized legal knowledge, but also medical knowledge around the killing of vulnerable people?
So what we say about this book isn't specifically about assisted suicide or euthanasia, but we do make clear in a number of answers to a number of the questions here that the church's constant teaching is that assisted suicide and euthanasia are grave moral evils. Now, what's confusing for people is, let's say you had a situation, an example I always use, two patients in two rooms next to each other, both on ventilators, and assume that the moral analysis has been already done, that in room A, it is moral to remove the ventilator. If you remove the ventilator, the person dies, the underlying disease takes its course, and the person dies. Now you have the soul is separated from the body at some point, and you have a corpse. But assume the same situation where the patient is incapacitated on a ventilator in room B, and the moral analysis has been done in that person's situation, it would be immoral to remove it. But if you remove it, the underlying disease takes its course, and the patient dies. Now, what's confusing for people is the same act of removing the ventilator, the same situation, same result, two people die, but why is one moral and one not? And that is, people are confused. Well, is that assisted suicide? So the church's teaching is clear. If you make the moral analysis and the care is disproportionate or extraordinary, removing someone from a medical intervention is not the equivalent of assisted suicide or euthanasia, but simply recognizing that a person is in a state where nothing can be done and the underlying disease will take it. So the danger that we try to, the two extremes that we try to avoid in the book is either pushing people to death too soon, like many countries do with assisted suicide and euthanasia, or over-medicalizing people when there's no realistic chance and there's no moral duty to continue interventions. Now, again, that's a difficult prudential judgment, and we hope that the book sets forth principles that helps people. I think if there was any takeaway from this, it's prepare before the crisis. Go home and talk with your spouse, your adult children, your friends, anyone who's going to have a say in this decision-making process for you, and talk about what the church teaches, read up, form your conscience well before the crisis. If you do that, you have a much better chance of getting it right. And of course, at the end of the day, this book is also about happiness. You would think, well, why is it about happiness? Because ultimately, we all want to try and strive to do God's will. And if you make good decisions at the end of life, you'll be in that situation.
Thank you so much, Nick.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Of course.
You can purchase Nicholas Nikas's book, Now and at the Hour of Our Death, Making Moral Decisions at the End of Life, on Ignatius.com and find the book through the search bar. That does it for this edition of EWTN Pro-Life Weekly. Don't forget to sign up for our newsletter, The Pro-Life Pulse, EWTN.com/pro-life. Remember, life is a gift. Your life is a gift. God bless.